We're talking with Jim Dunn now, and he's just come back from East Timor. Jim, last time we spoke with you, we were about to head out to East Timor, and it was just before Alkatiri resigned as Prime Minister and José Ramos Horta took on the role of Prime Minister. Now, could you just tell us why and what was your mission when you were going to East Timor?
Well, I was invited to go over by Horta. That time he was acting Prime Minister, to help with the crisis, because there were all sorts of problems to do with it. And that's why I went over in a private capacity, and indeed I paid my own fare. I wasn't enriched by the particular organisation. And I stayed with him for about 8 days, and I was given the task of preparing, in broad outline, an agenda for the new government, which, of course, came into office while I was there, to get East Timor, as it were, out of that mess and try and disentangle it from the political crisis that had developed and, of course, end the violence that was still going on, though at a fairly low level.
And what did you see when you got there?
Well, when I got there, the streets were almost empty, very few vehicles. The taxi drivers went around. There wasn't any violence in the streets very much, but on the edge of the town you could see where many houses had been destroyed, burnt. In the township itself, there wasn't so much evidence of that, a little bit of evidence of it. But what was very striking was everything was run down, even the Palacio de Governo, the administrative palace. Half the windows seemed to have the panes broken, and there were holes in the wall, and everything was looking rather grubby. But I suppose the striking thing to me was that, because I moved in straight away into the government's administration, the Palace of Administration, that half departments were not staffed, or with very few of their staff. Most people had walked away, and it didn't just mean villagers or people living in houses. It really meant that the employees, the public servants, the people who were implementing policies, had really left their departments, except for the hospital, the health service, which worked very well. Indeed, the minister moved into one of the hospitals so he could direct it from an operational situation, so to speak. And in the foreign ministry, less than half of the people were in the office. It was really, and the people who were in their offices were walking around looking as if they didn't quite know what to do. That was the scene. It really, the scene, I would have to say, and I actually wrote this later, particularly as I looked at it more closely, what had taken place was a massive collapse in public confidence in the government, almost in nationhood, people feeling that somehow they couldn't rule themselves any longer, and many people really saying, oh, could the UN come back and take us over and just simply stay there? Very few, a couple of people, thought things might have been better under Indonesia. But generally those were people who hadn't experienced the really rough times. There was certainly a general feeling of a lack of trust, a lack of confidence in the institutions of government. That was a big task for the new government to face up to.
The UN, I think there's some discussion now about, you know, the UN coming back and how Australia's role fits in with the UN role.
Well, of course, there was a UN mission there, which was to end its mandate on the 20th of this of August, and it has done. It's a much smaller mission with an advisory capacity, though a very important mission, a mission under Hasegawa, a Japanese. And I met many of its leaders at this time who were very worried about the crisis. Now, this mission obviously was inadequate for the task ahead and the task that they were suddenly confronted with, because behind this collapse were the events of the past months, which, of course, the blame had been laid on Mari Alkatiri, who, of course, resigned under pressure. I personally think Mali Alkatiri had a lot to answer for, but I think most of his crimes were of omission rather than commission. I have great reservations about the allegations that he was behind a conspiracy to give arms to one side in order to sort of start a kind of civil war. And I think probably he took the brunt of accusations which probably related to the whole conduct of government and a general failure, not only on the part of the government, but on the part of those financial institutions advising it, like the World Bank. And we mustn't forget that it wasn't long before this crisis that Mali Alkatiri had been praised by none less than Paul Wolfowitz for his extraordinary performance in managing the economy. But as one could see when you got to East Timor, one of the basic problems was that the books looked good, and far from being a Marxist, Mali Alkatiri was probably more of a monetarist. He was balancing the books well. But in dealing with the mounting social problems, particularly those caused by the massive unemployment in a country where there's no unemployment benefits to be handed out, in not dealing with that, I mean, his government had really seriously contributed to the crisis. But I'd still have to say that I think all shared a responsibility. And at Mari, I spent some time with him, and he really insisted that he had no involvement in these conspiracies he was accused of. And I think, for my part, as I told him then, I wasn't there to lay blame on him, and I think what we should do is wait the outcome of this UN inquiry, which only a couple of weeks began its work, and will report in October on what was behind the events of May and April and May this year that led to the crisis. But nevertheless, what had happened is that we had a new government full of energy and ideas, but of course it really had to get people to implement them. That was obviously a big task. And on the one hand, to get public servants to implement, to take action. And one side in particular was lamentably absent, and that was the police. Because the police in Dili, after several of them were killed by troops, they actually left Dili and went to the mountains. There were no police. The only police, as they came in, first were the Australian troops and some other troops, Malaysians, and then of course some CIVPOL, civilian police, came in, particularly from Australia, and the streets soon, law and order was restored. But still at night there were outbreaks of violence, once again I think involving young men, unemployed people whose loyalty these days is to particular gangs they've joined up with, people who were using this almost fictitious East-West division, and I say fictitious because it hadn't existed before, to justify their attacking one side or the other. And this certainly was a big problem. And another big problem was that even though we suddenly had a new government with lots of dynamism and coming out making important statements, the Timorese in the refugee camp, 150,000 of them, were still very reluctant to go back to their houses. They were quite afraid. I went to several of these camps, and these people were full of fear. They didn't want to go. They feared that going back would expose them to violence.
I wasn't going to dwell on this, but I did see an article in the Herald recently that the people in the refugee camps actually felt that they were being targeted by these gangs because they were Fretilin supporters and seen as East Timorese. So it seems that has sort of raised its head again, even though that, yeah, it was sort of rubbish in the early stages of the trouble, but it seems to have. Was that a particular journalist or?
Well, I don't really think that's quite accurate. I think certainly it is true that Fretilin people have now and then been targeted, but some of the fighting was within the camps because both sides were there. There was a bit of targeting. I think most of the targeting wasn't in the refugee camps, but the houses. They were targeting houses of Fretilin members. And this is what was very worrying, because although on one hand one could be led to believe that these were these wild gangs of young men with machetes or katanas, they're called in Timor, racing around, attacking houses and looting. In fact, the attacking was very selective, and I believe that there were political forces behind it. Some groups, perhaps on the right, not Fretlin, but on the other side, I think were probably involved in creating instability to suit their own ends. And don't forget that in April, of course, there will be a general election, and it was, this, of course, has added an incendiary element, if you like, to the crisis because of the expectations that raises.
So it looks more like a political divide rather than an ethnic divide.
Well, the East-West was not ethnic at all, really. I mean, it was something that came, in fact, really, rather than about politics now, it's really about the Indonesian invasion and the fact that when the Indonesians invaded East Timor, the first area they settled was the western part near the border, and it was there that they recruited young Timorese to participate in two Indonesian units that were used. This is a kind of indirect attack with Indonesian officers and NCOs, but Timorese soldiers. And these, of course, were the two of the units with the worst records in terms of human rights abuses. But many of those Timorese came from that western area because that's where they were recruited from. And once again, when the militia violence occurred in 1999, the biggest militia units and the most vicious were in this western part, where they were controlled by Timorese with strong links to Indonesia. And one might add, of course, though, just to keep the balance so that it's not just east-west on one side. As it also turned out, the worst atrocities were committed against the people of the west, Swai, Maliana, Likisar and Pasabe and some others, where hundreds of people were killed, whereas in the eastern part, the only major atrocity cost about 11 Timorese lives. So really, the divide, it's not as simple as all that. A lot of it was a result of Indonesia's political intervention, the mobilizing of young men in that area to support them with a measure of success. And also because Indonesia developed to a large extent those towns near the border. And many Indonesians lived there. They also had some transmigrants there. So it was under greater influence. So that was probably a factor. But the other factor, of course, is that in present day, the eastern part of Timor is much more developed than the west, and that's unfortunate. But, you know, the west isn't just about the border. Dili's in the west. So really, it's something fictitious, in a sense, almost as if some bitter dispute occurred in a football match and was just kept going.
Oh, that's interesting, Jim, yeah. And, yeah, I know you. Just one quick last question. How do you see certainly the administration of José Ramos Horta and, you know, the prospects for East Timor from now?
Well, I think Jose's got off to a good start. He's very active. He's taken a very centrist position. He's well respected by Fretlin, really, because, of course, he's one of the Fretlin founders, one of the key founders, even though he's not a member now. And he, unlike some others, he didn't leave Fretlin over some dispute. It was just that in the past he decided to move into a more independent role and less aligned with parties. And we mustn't forget that the government he controls is almost, apart from a few members, is still largely a Fretlin government. And the Deputy Prime Minister, Stanislav da Silva, is one of the Fretlin leaders and a highly respected one, and a very good minister in this largely Fretlin government. And I think the leadership change is a good one at the time. I mean, I think Mari Alkatiri had a lot of talents and a lot of ability, but as things have turned out, he did lose a lot of support, and not least because of his failure to deal with this military problem. And really, he should have dealt with it earlier, and it should never have been a matter of simply sacking 600 troops, almost half the army, because they walked out of the barracks. When that happens, you sit down and talk to them. But by just sacking them, that really wasn't a good enough solution, and simply got things going. Just one other point I'd like to make, if I've got time, is that the new resolution has just been not only this, but in the past 24 hours, concluded at the Security Council. The new resolution, which is 1704, creates a new mission for East Timor. It's going to be called, I think it's UNMIT, it's an integrated committee, a mission for East Timor, with 1,600 peacekeepers, 608 peacekeepers, 34 military mission, and quite a lot of civilians dealing with the problems. The one thing I was a bit troubled about, because is that Australia pressed for its military component to be commanded separately, and most members of the Security Council, with the exception of only two strong supporters of Australia, the United States and Japan, also wanted the mission to be integrated. Well, the Security Council has bent to pressures from Australia, and I suspect at this time that's not least because the Australians offered to pay for the military that they're controlling. That cuts down the cost to the UN. But nevertheless, what it does mean, I think what is disappointing about it, even though I think there are excellent military commanders who could do a good job, is that there was a great need, in my view, for an integrated mission, because the problem is an integrated one. It's not just about the military or the police. It's about many aspects, about underdevelopment, and all these issues need to be looked at together. And I thought, ideally, it needed an integrated approach to deal with the problems that East Timor is facing. It may work quite well this way, but in a sense it will mean that there are two forces in East Timor, the UN mission, and then there's this Australian force which enjoys a support of the UN, but its main authority is that it's been asked by the Security Council to cooperate with the UN mission, well, which of course kind of leaves it up to the commanders, or in this case perhaps the politicians involved. And I would really like to have seen it as part of a UN mission, because it was always an international operation. And I don't think anything international in the past failed. I don't think that was the problem. If anything, if there was any failure that contributed to the crisis in East Timor, it was the failure of countries like ours and the United States that really pressed the United Nations to end its mission as quickly as possible, because of the cost, the donor countries, who didn't want it to continue. And by doing that, of course, they brought the mission to a quick end. And I think 2.5 years, well, really it was only 2 years, to take a nation from the devastation, the zero level of destruction of November 1999 to independence in 2.5 years was a very tall order indeed. And it's not surprising that that it has had problems. And I'd like to mention that I think many of these problems it did inherit from this short mandate, which most of us felt was too short. Because what actually happened is East Timor got independence, the UN mission, the massive mission, went away, and that took away, of course, 2/3 of the economy of East Timor, which was dependent on services. And when the mission, and on the eve of independence, there was 60% unemployment, and of course it stayed that way. And to leave a new, very weak, very poor country with such massive unemployment was, in my view, and I expressed it at the time, in 2002, leaving the new nation with a time bomb.